Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Lynn Murphy is an American linguist teaching in England. She's uniquely suited to explore the relationship and rivalry between English and English. In other words, she studies the prejudices and stereotypes and insecurities that shape our understanding of how English works in two different countries. Lynn Murphy pens the award-winning blog Separated by a Common Language. Her new book is called The Prodigal Tongue, The Love-Hate Relationship Between American and British English. She joins us on the phone now from New York. Lynn Murphy, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So living in England and teaching linguistics as an American, you must be a lightning rod or a magnet for these kind of conversations. Tell me how often people are approaching you with, criticism or questions or using you as a punching bag.
Well, I mean, before I started writing the blog, it was just the occasional thing interacting with people. When I first moved there, there was a 75-year-old taking our undergraduate course, and he was not, terribly happy with an American telling him how English worked. But for the most part, you get along fine. People are used to American voices. But when I started writing the blog after I'd lived in England for 6 years, then I really became a magnet for people wanting to tell me just what annoyed them about American English. So I've had a lot of that, and that was a lot of the impetus for writing the book.
All right. So why are people so passionate about this? What's behind it? What drives it?
Well, part of it is just that your language is a big part of your identity. So if people don't approve of how you talk, or if people talk differently from you and you feel like the way they talk is taking over, is more powerful than how you talk, then you'll feel a little bit attacked personally, right? Because your language is part of you. But there's also a big part there about British English was the original world English, right? In the 19th century, the British Empire was huge. The sun never set on it. And they took the English language all over the world, where it's used, as an official language in many, many countries today. And in the 20th century, it's been American economic power and American media, television, pop music, movies, all that, that's really been spreading English, and American business culture very much spreading English around the world. And so the flavor of the English that's being spoken internationally has changed a little bit. And, if you're a British person who's proud of how you speak and who thinks that, spelling color with a U is the right way to spell it, then you're going to feel like maybe that's not quite right.
How crazed do people get, though, about this? It's more than just you have a word for it, even, Amerilexicosis.
Yeah.
Define what that is.
Well, I talk about how, most prejudices are based in fear, and so people are afraid of American English a bit, but sometimes they go a little bit further and just get downright crazy and hallucinate American English where it doesn't even exist, so that's what I call Amerilexicosis, so for example, in Britain for the last few decades, people have started pronouncing controversy as controversy. And of course, a lot of people don't like that the pronunciation is changing. And so I have read, no small number of times, we must stop this awful Americanism coming into Britain or coming into other parts of the world. I lived in South Africa, and that pronunciation was a big matter of complaint there. But people just assumed because it was new and it was different, it must be American. And of course, nobody in America says controversy.
And on the American side, you say that we have sometimes a bit of an inferiority complex. I'm not sure that I see that in South Dakota, but tell me a little bit how Americans view this.
Yeah, I mean, I think on the East Coast, that's got a different relationship with Britain than the West does and the Midwest, because as America moved westward, the influence of Britain became less. But you do see all over America people saying things like, Oh, I love a British accent. Right. Oh, isn't it so cute when they talk? Oh, isn't it so sexy when they talk? And especially people who consider themselves Anglophiles. I mean, a lot more people in America seem to consider themselves Anglophiles than a lot of other countries that they could be, you know, lovers of. And so right. There are a lot of people out there who, you know, can't get enough of The Crown or Downton Abbey or Harry Potter, and for whom a big part of the attraction of those things is the fact that they're just that little bit different from the kind of language you'd hear in America.
I was reading your book, or I had began your book at the same time NPR was running a story about some people in America who were teaching accent reduction schools for new immigrants. And the idea was that, you know, in a political climate where it's not always popular to be a recent immigrant, if you could change your accent more quickly, you'd, you know, maybe have a better chance at landing certain kinds of jobs. And I was reading your book at the same time, and I thought, oh, well, they should just be teaching them an English accent because they'll make more money. We need to put those two things together in an economic model, so that might work.
I mean, when languages, you see where you see English schools in other countries, in non-English speaking countries, very often they will advertise explicitly, teaches a British accent or teaches an American accent, but more likely to, you know, I see more teaches a British accent, because there is some sense that because that's the island that the language was first spoken in, that must be the best one.
Yeah. How far back does this go? You talk about even Thomas Jefferson being criticized for the way his language was morphing because of the word belittle. So this is this goes back some time.
It goes back even further than that. So you've got, even before America became independent, there were people writing in Britain about, this man came back from America, and I can hear that his English is a bit corrupted, or these words are coming over, and they're ridiculous. So that's already happening in the 18th century, and then as America becomes independent, you've got some people, like Thomas Jefferson in particular, who are very excited by the possibilities that English offers and by the opportunities to really make an American English happen. And Jefferson was a big fan of making up new words, and belittle is one of them. He made up the word Anglophobe or Anglophobia for fear of England, and quite a few others. So he's the first cited user of about at least a dozen words in the Oxford English Dictionary, I think.
So let's have some fun with some of the content of this book, because it's thoughtful and it's academic in some places, but it's also really delightful with some of the words that are different. You mentioned color being spelled differently. So how, you know, some of it is pronunciation, some of it's spelling, and some of it is just speaking differently or using different terms that are untranslatable. So let's talk a little bit about spelling first. What is the significance of, you know, theater versus theater, or color versus color, or things such as that?
That was sort of America's most decisive act of linguistic independence after breaking up with England. Noah Webster, you know, the man who's associated with Webster's Dictionary, he wanted to do really severe changes to spelling to make it more like how we talk, you know, because English spelling is notoriously difficult. And so he had some very radical ideas. You know, if we had followed him entirely, we'd be spelling tongue, T-U-N-G, and things, you know, spelling is, I-Z. But so he tried to get a lot of those changes going, and of course people weren't having that. You know, if you change your spelling system too much, you won't be able to read the books, you know, of a generation before, or you'd need translations of British books. So his urges were tempered a bit, and so the words that we have now that are spelled differently from British words are mostly ones that Noah Webster put in his dictionary and that passed the test of time. So things like color, you know, taking the U out of color, reversing the R and E in center and theater, spelling something like, I've just lost my example, something like fetus right. with a E rather than an OE, those sorts of things, made English a little bit more like it, spelt a bit more like it sounds, whereas the British tradition is to keep something that looks more like the old-time Norman and scribes who spoke Latin and Norman French would have spelt things. Yeah. But the thing about Noah Webster's spellings is that the ones that were successful, they weren't unknown in Britain. So, you know, other dictionaries coming out about the same time in England sometimes spelt color without the U as well.
And pronunciation, so, garage, and what is it? Garage?
Garage.
I can't even do the English pronunciation of garage or aluminum either. How do those pronunciations change so dramatically?
Well, they all have their own stories. So in the case of garage and garage, now I have to say not every English person says garage. Many say garage. But that's a word that came into English from French only in the 20th century, you know, when we needed it for cars. And English has a tendency to take French words and put the accent on the first syllable. So instead of saying ballet, they say ballet. And instead of saying beret for the hat, they say beret. And it's the same thing for garage. You know, so if you say garage with the accent on the first syllable, garage, then it's a small step from there to garage. Whereas Americans do the opposite. They tend to put the accent on the second syllable of French loan words. The French don't do either of those things, so neither of us really has a claim to be more French than the other. But that little change offers the opportunity for the pronunciations to develop in different ways. Yeah. And in the case of aluminum versus aluminium, the guy who discovered it and named it first started out with aluminium, I think, as his word for it, and then he changed that to aluminum. But the very same year, he decided it needed an I and changed it to aluminium. And so it was just a matter of which one of this guy's spellings and pronunciations any particular society went with. And in America, because the Chemical Society, the American Chemical Society or something like that, took a decision to take out the I, that's what we've got in America.
Advertisement and advertisement. Same thing, just an individual story about one or the other?
Yeah, well, it's probably more, you know, sort of a pattern of we put For long words like that, we have patterns of where we put the accent on the syllables. So, you know, in Britain, you might hear something like contribute as well as contribute. You know, and those stresses on the syllables, you know, are moving around a bit in Britain at this time. So, you know, they could differ more in the future.
And you say the beauty of this is not so much in, you know, putting on our boxing gloves and duking it out to say who's right or who's wrong, but just realizing how fluid language is. And what are your thoughts on whether or not we should fight for dominance over a certain part of our mother tongue?
Well, I'm not a fighter. I look at language and I just wonder at it because it is such a hugely complex thing that we learn to use without even thinking about it. And it tells so many stories about our culture. And I think if instead of getting into the argument about whether it should be aluminum or aluminium, we just pause and say, isn't it interesting how English can support both of those things? Then we might enjoy it more.
So I have a self-indulgent request because this is something, and you might not know the answer, it's not in your book, but because you're a linguist, I can't let you off the phone. So words like landline, right? There was a time when we had phones, and then we all got mobile phones or cell phones, and then suddenly we had to call that phone at home something else. And then the word landline appears, or computer, and all of a sudden the word desktop appears. What are those, and do they have a name?
Yes, there is a name for those. They're called retronyms.
Oh, so I love you. Thank you. I've been asking everybody I know about that for months. Retronyms.
The words that come up because they're words for old things, new words for old things that come up because there's something new to compare those old things to. The meaning of the word, the original word, like telephone or like... I can't think of what other example.
Right. I was doing that this morning too. It was like computer. So, you know, you had a computer and then all of a sudden there was the laptop and then you had to come up with, well, this is a desktop. And
exactly.
Then that's the first time we started using. And eventually, I suppose, car or, you know, something.
And rotary dial phone, right?
For
when we moved to push buttons, we needed that. And, you know, someday we'll have to have other words for the phones we use now because they will be superseded by other things.
Exactly. You have cleared up a great mystery because I'd heard that word once and then I lost it. Now I've written it down.
I'm so glad I could help.
Talk to me just before we let you go a little bit about some of these lost in translation words. And I've discovered you on Twitter, and I just recommend everybody follow you on Twitter as well because I'm looking forward to Untranslatable October very much. And talk to me about some of these words that, you know, if you're in a different place, can really get you into trouble because you've said something you didn't mean to say, but yet you're all speaking English.
Yeah. So in terms of Untranslatable October, on Twitter, I do a difference of the day every day. So today it was Americans say swim team and the British have to say swimming team. You know, all these little differences that I come up with in everyday conversation. And in October, I change that and I do a word that the other country doesn't have an equivalent for. And there are, I thought after the first year I'd not be able to do an entire month of that again, and I'm just on my seventh one. So there are enough words that, or expressions that are just different enough that you cannot quite capture them in the other language. One that strikes me is jobsworth, which is a British term for somebody who will only do as much as their job's worth. So somebody who sticks, you know, like, that's not in my job description. Mm-hmm. And that's a great word to have. And I think the fact that Britain has it tells a little story about customer service in Britain. But then America, you know, one thing that America's got that Britain doesn't have is we've got an entire vocabulary for how you want your eggs done, your fried eggs. You know, there's no equivalent of sunny side up or over easy there. And, you know, there are various restaurant words, I think, because Americans started eating out a lot before British people started eating out a lot, like bussing tables. I mean, bussing is a word that doesn't really have an equivalent in British. You could say clearing tables, but that doesn't give you the sense that it's specifically in a restaurant.
All right. Is jobsworth a noun, a verb? Because I'm employing
noun,
it.
Yeah. Some,
it's
some,
a noun. Okay.
Somebody is a jobsworth. Right. Yeah. And then you also... Sorry, go ahead.
You finished. That's all right.
I was just going to say, you asked about words that get you into trouble. And the one that you always have, two that you should remember is you should not use the word fanny in Britain because it means something much more personal, a much more personal body part of a woman in America than it means in Britain, or than in Britain than it means in America. And another word to watch out for is quite, because for Americans, quite means very. And for Brits, quite is a bit all over the place, but it can mean not very. So if somebody is quite amused by what you say, don't take it as a compliment.
Lynn Murphy, we need to have you on once a month. But you can read her book and follow her on Twitter. The book is called The Prodigal Tongue, The Love-Hate Relationship Between American and British English. Lynn, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.